Welcome, welcome to another Bold Brave Woman podcast. This is Mayvu. I am your host, and oh my gosh, I'm so thrilled to be here today because I get to talk with one of my most favorite people that just came into my life in the last couple of years. She is a badass, fun, powerful woman who's up to something really big. Her name is Joanne Butcher. She is a coach for filmmakers and an educator, and all around a very luscious woman in San Francisco that I get to call one of my clients and also one of my new friends and colleagues in the Bay Area here in California. And so tonight we are talking about Joanne's journey and why filmmaking and what happened to her life and what makes her a bold and brave woman. So come on in, Joanne.
Hi, May. How are you?
I'm delighted. I'm delighted to have you here. And as you and everyone knows, you know, Bold Brave Woman Radio is about sharing powerful, heartwarming stories of us, ordinary women living an extraordinary life. You know, sometimes these moments in life impose themselves onto us, and then we have to learn to deal with them. And through them, we rise into our current powerful self. And other times, we create them. So, and then we have to go through all that creation and all that. So I'm really excited to hear about your stories. And I'm also just tickled pink to talk to a filmmaker and a coach of filmmakers. You know? So let's start there. Why filmmaking?
Well, I've always loved film and I've always been crazy about film, and I think that's true for a lot of people, so I don't think that I'm special in any way about that. It's only been for me in the last couple of years that I've really been able to put two and two together and realize that the reason that I'm so passionate about film is that I grew up in a home where it was very important for me to stay silent and to avoid trouble by, you know, not talking. And, May, you know me, I love to talk. So that was probably a big job for a little girl to do in a home. But silent
So can we just slow this down for a second and you say you grew up in a home that encouraged silence and not talking. Is it like secrecy, or what's your version? Let's go a little deeper into this. Where did you grow up? What happened?
So I grew up in London, and my parents were, my father was a businessman. He was working in his own business, and my mother, for most of my childhood, was a stay-at-home mom. They both came from very poor backgrounds. My mother from a very poor working class background, where she had to go to work at the age of 16 to help support the family. And my father from a third world country, where he had been working from very, very young. And they are both brilliant people, but they were not able to go to college or to pursue that kind of life that middle-class children get to have. And so they were both incredibly intelligent people who had a lot stymied. But my father went on. Now I would say he's a very, very successful person. My mother never had that opportunity. Everything that was brilliant about her was completely squashed, and which I think is also true of very many women who were becoming adults in the 50s. And so my father was a very, very big, very, very overworked, stressed out, angry man. There's alcoholism in both sides of my family. So a lot of alcohol, a lot of anger, and my mother's big lesson to me was, don't upset your father. And it's, you know, I know now that it's not possible to not upset my father, but I didn't know that then. And so I learned that the best thing to do was to be quiet. The best thing to do was to hide. The best thing to do was to be invisible. And I learned to do that very well.
And what happened? What happened when you upset your father?
Well, when I was in my teens, when I was about 17 or 18, my father attacked me and strangled me, and I thought that I was going to die. And I think that that strangulation thing on my throat is another piece that was very much for me about staying silent. And so my personal internal journey has really been about being able to open up and speak, and very specifically speak about myself, which is why it's such an honor that I'm doing this with you today, and speaking about myself. And that for me, being able to tell one's personal story, being able to tell any story, is so profound. I now understand that for me, it's a life and death issue. Storytelling.
Wow.
And that's how I come to filmmaking.
I have to say, I'm still back on the scene of my, you know, my father pound on me and sat on me and strangled me. I'm just still kind of like, wow, like how does, it's just so, I'm just so blown away by so many angles of that scene, you know, talking about filmmaking, right? I'm like having a movie playing out in my head right now. I'm like, what's it like for him to be on top of you, strangling you? It's like, what could justify such violence onto your own daughter, right? And you being a girl of 15, it's like, how big could she possibly be? And what the? It's such an impossible scene, and then the rippling effect of that into your life, probably into now even.
Yes, I think, and that particular moment, I did not actually tell anybody for years and years and years. But I lived in absolute terror of my father.
And what does that feel like? You know, what does it mean to live in absolute terror? What are the sensations? What are the thoughts? What's in that?
I don't think there are many sensations left. I think most sensation leaves, and that there's a numbness that is replaced by terror. And when you talk about the scene of, you know, a movie of that scene, I lived for my, you know, up until I was about 30, I would say, when I got sober, I lived with that picture of my father being a huge figure that just filled up my vision. That was all I could see. And actually, I say that, you know, my life changed at 30 when I got sober, but the truth is that that image was still there for years and years and years. It was as if I lived in a world where I couldn't see past anything except my father, and that image blocking my view.
Wow.
And yes, it definitely still has effects till today. But it's been a lifetime's work to try to be able to switch the focus from that giant figure that blocked my view to being able to put some focus on myself.
What would you say? And looking back in the movie of your life, what would you say was the first moment where you felt like you had to be a bold and brave woman, or young, or person?
That's a great question.
I know, I haven't asked that question with other people yet, but suddenly that question came up, and I'm like, wow, yeah. When was the very first moment that we realized shoot, I have to be bold and brave in this world.
Well, I started doing some brave things to save my life when I was pretty young. But I don't think that I would have called myself bold, because I don't think they were done with boldness. I think that I was brave. I lived in secret away from my family after I graduated from college. I eventually took a restraining order out on my father. I moved to another country to get away. I made choices that were purely about saving my life. And I think that that was incredibly brave of me. But I don't think I ever did it in a bold way. I did it in a terrified way.
Well, that's the irony of this thing, of this game of being. And this is why I... Not only do I create the Bold Brave Woman Club, where we can commune on Facebook and on LinkedIn to share our stories and share ourselves to each other, but these stories are teaching me and all of us the complexity of being bold and brave. There are a few times where, when we're being bold, we can feel it. We can suck it up and boldly go forward, right? And we can feel that along the way. And then there are other times that what you just said here is so profound. It's like, I didn't feel bold. I was just trying to save my life.
Yes, and I think that.
Go ahead. Sorry.
Well, I was
just
thinking
so about this part.
I was thinking about movies. You know, I just went to see Dunkirk. I just went to see Dunkirk twice in a row.
God,
you know,
yeah, right.
The stories that we, this is a vast generalization. There are lots of kinds of stories, but a lot of the stories we see are we think of, you know, soldiers going off to war and their bravery. And I think that in our lifetime, we have come to the moment where we can tell a story like Dunkirk, which shows how, yes, those men were all brave. They all signed up. They were wearing a uniform. But there are moments in life where bravery is really purely about surviving. And often when you speak to a hero, and you say, wow, that was so heroic, they'll say, I was just doing what I was supposed to do, you know?
You know, oh, my God, you just helped me link it together for myself, too, because when I tell people about my escape out of Vietnam stories and the three times that we try and the failing and all the stuff and then getting on that tiny little fishing boat and all this stuff, people always say, wow, you were so brave. You were so courageous. You know, you know all these big words. And I didn't feel bold and brave at that time. I just had to do what I had to do.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, with one foot in front of the other, and we and things happened to us, and then we just responded to them. And thank God it all worked out well, kind of thing. And the escape itself actually was the easy and fun part. It's the coming to the United States and living every day and building life one step at a time and facing prejudice and all this other, you know, crazy, non-visible thing. So, but part of why I'm so passionate about doing these conversations and capturing these stories is that it's like I want to remind all of us that even when we're going through those moments where you didn't feel bold and brave, it is, you are being bold and brave, and that it's important for you to notice that and love yourself and appreciate yourself for that, right? So it's just kind of like, wow, taking the time to look back and going, I was very bold and brave to be that age, 15, 16, 18, 19. We know nothing, right? Looking back, it's like, oh, my God, we were so innocent. And you had to do all these big things, like take out restraining orders against your own father. It's like, what the hell is that? And what did it have to lead up to get to that place? Because I'm pretty sure it wasn't like he made me mad and I went and got a restraining order. You know,
right.
there's a whole bunch of shit that has to build up to get to that. So
Tell
us more.
Well, I was just also thinking a big part of my story is that I, from a very, very young age, was addicted to alcohol. I'm sure that there, you know, there were drugs along the way as well, but getting sober is a huge part of my story. That happened when I was 30, and it took me many years. And this is, to me, a really crucial way of starting to see myself as a bold and brave woman. But it took me many years to realize, you know, my alcoholism, my drinking and drugging, was actually a part of helping me save my life. And many years later, I was visiting my mother, and what would happen would be every time I would visit my mother, I would go into the most profound depression, and I would lay in bed and I wouldn't be able to get out of bed. And one day, a friend of mine got on the phone with me and talked to me as I put on clothes and left the apartment. And as I left the apartment, there was an outside door that would swing shut. And I heard that door swing shut behind me, and it brought back all these memories of when I was much younger and I had used alcohol or my addiction to men or what, or my workaholism or whatever it was to leave the apartment. And I heard that door swing shut, and I realized that I was grateful to my addictive personality, because that's what got me out of that house. That the depression would have had me lay in bed and die. But there were things in the world that drew me out, and that I eventually came to call addictions. But eventually
we're going to have to slow this one down, Joanne, because it's so rich again. Thank you so much for being, I knew this was going to be a really rich and complex conversation. So we are living up to my expectations. So let's say that again. My addiction saved my life.
That's right. My addiction saved my life. That the pull of the alcohol or the boyfriend or the you know, 80-hour a week job, all of those things were stronger than this huge desire I had, which was to lay in bed and die. And so I had been in recovery for many, many, many years before I had this realization, but I heard the door slam shut that day, and I realized, thank you. Thank you to all of those things that I counted as being the weak parts of myself or the addictive parts of myself or the parts of myself that I didn't approve of. Thank you to all those things for getting me out of the house, getting me, in my case, out of the country, getting me away from my family so that I could begin the healing work that was to occupy my mind for the next 20, 30 years.
Baby, I so wanted to know all the details, and then what happened? And then, because it just kind of just this whole concept of having to fight so hard to get away from your family. It's supposed to be a place that nurtures you and spawn you and give you birth and, you know, clap and champion you and all this stuff. And yet here it is. I feel like I'm watching some animal documentary. You know, those are my favorite things to watch on TV.
Yes.
And like this embryo or this frog is or something, you know, the animal is trying so hard to get away from from her roots.
Yes.
Her mommy and daddy, so that she can be safe in the world, which is so ironic.
Right. Yes, and it's true for so many people. And when I have an instant and deep connection with people who have also had to let go of their families. I just met with a young woman yesterday, 27 years old. She's already had to leave her very dangerous family behind. When I first moved to San Francisco and worked at the Y, there were kids there at the Y who would be homeless rather than join the gangs that their fathers required them to join. I mean, this is something that is relatively common. And I really have a huge empathy for anybody who has had to walk away from their family. But sometimes that's what we've had to do. And
it's a
hard place, a hard place to be.
I know. You know, it's like people always say, there's a lot of like empathy that goes to me for having born in Vietnam and having to escape out and, you know, starting at zero and all this stuff. But I think my story is lightweight compared to being born here in the beautiful United States that has everything and surrounded by everything and the pressure of having everything and then end up in a gang family or blah, 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 and then having to fight for your life and pull yourself out and, you know, being strangled, thrown on the floor, and beaten by your own father. And it's just kind of like, man, I'll take my journey any day. That's lightweight compared to what you guys go through.
Yeah, that difference between that external enemy and the enemy at home. And that's a very difficult place for people to recognize. Now, I just mentioned the kids at the Y. It was much easier for them to become, to educate themselves, to learn about the problems of gangs and violence in the streets. It was much easier for them to learn to tell that story than to learn to tell the story about the sexual abuse at home.
Oh, wow.
Tell the story about mom being sick with HIV. The story of not having enough food to eat. You know, those stories were so difficult for them to tell.
Mm.
Even after they had been trained to tell the stories of the more external threats in their lives.
Right. So what story is harder for you to tell about your life?
Well, fast forward many years, I had moved to San Francisco. I was working at the Y. I was a very successful professional. I had been involved in the arts for many years and had always been poor, and I decided, no, it's time for me to be an adult and get the big job and earn some real money. And I was on my way. You know, I was earning about $100,000 a year, and I saw this career that I could never have imagined I would have. I was like, oh, I'm going to be earning $150,000 in a few years. I was like, I've made it. And all of a sudden, I was sick. And I was too sick to work for 7 years. During those 7 years, I lost everything. And when I say I lost everything, you know, I didn't only lose everything financially. I lost my apartment. I lost my career. I lost any money, savings, whatever. But I lost everything. I had no friends, no social life. Thank God for my 12-step community, because there, you know, at the weekends I could make a morning meeting and then I'd go home to bed. So I could get out in the mornings and then I'd go back to bed. And I like to explain, my illness was migraines. It wasn't anything life-threatening, but my life was absolutely destroyed. Absolutely destroyed.
Well, that in itself is kind of crazy-making too, because like if you had some big, like, there's always this crazy need inside our brain to have to justify. So I could just imagine, or I don't know if this is true for you, but I'm like, if I was in your shoes, I'd be, like, judging myself so harshly, because I'd be
I just have
migraine. What the fuck is wrong with me? Why can't I just, like, get up and do things, right? It's not
right.
like I...
Right.
Yeah. my whole life go into the toilet with just migraine?
Yep. And my lesson that it took me 7 years to learn was that, you know, it made me so sad that I saw other people's lives moving forward, because that's what happens in life. You know, people got married, people moved, they got jobs, they got promotions, all of these things. And I lay in bed. And I could not function. What I learned in those 7 years was that if I couldn't move, if I was so ill that I couldn't do anything and I had to just watch as deadlines passed or whatever happened, that was actually my job, that's what I had to learn to do. And I had to learn to be able to sit still and let go of the fear. I remember at year 5 or 6, you know, I would still be living in this terror of what, you know, was going to happen to me when I was homeless, living under the bridge and all of that. By year 6 or 7, I had learned a level of calmness and peace around not having control, not having any control in my life. And for some physiological reasons, or I don't know what reasons, but anyway, about 4 or 5 years ago, I started to change. The downturn started to move up very, very slowly. Very, very, very slowly.
I started to get a little better. Again, have to slow this down again.
Slow down.
Because I'm going to start calling you Oh Wise One, because, you know, it's like, Oh Wise One, you just gave us another piece here for us to really think about, which is, you said, you have to learn.
You know, May, that, I just have to stop you to hear you say that. Oh, my God. It's just to feel that. Because I do know that I've come a long way, that I've learned.
Yeah, right? Oh,
massive
baby.
Lessons in life, spiritual lessons.
Yeah, this is a badass one, but you said, that's why I had to stop it down, rewind, get to this place again, which is like, wait, you just said to us, when you were debilitated and could not move, could not do anything, and you're like watching everyone else progress past you, and that you're watching deadline fell apart, and you know the consequences of each deadline, and the bills not go paid, and you don't have money, and you have nothing left, and nothing left, and nothing left. That was your job. Holy shit. That was your job to watch this. And then it's your job. And as you sit there and work through that, you started to unwind what control all of us in, I'm pretty sure, in all around the world, but especially in the first world country, is this fear of not having, this fear of losing everything, this fear of not being out, being completely out of control. You know, like that's why you're the Oh Wise One. I'm like, oh my God, if that's what you got out of that, I think you got a fabulous ride, and you did a great job of like taking, like really listening to what life had to teach you.
Yeah.
And, like most of us are like avoiding that lesson. We're like, no, that's okay. We give it to Joanne. She's got it.
Yeah.
We heard it on the podcast, and let's just leave it at that.
Okay, I've done it. You don't need to.
That's right. Joanne did it for all of us. Thank you so much.
That's right.
You know, we like to keep our houses. We don't want to sleep under the bridge. We want, you know, it's like, I don't know if I could possibly lay there and watch deadline goes by and realize that this is now my new job.
But May, I never did end up under the bridge.
I know. How did that happen?
How did that happen?
Yeah.
Well,
how did you not end up under the bridge?
Well, that is the mystery.
Mm.
The mystery is, how did I not end up under the bridge? And so today, because let me tell you, that fear has not been 100% removed. And the more that I engage with the world today, the more likely that fear is going to return. But the truth is that I know that, you know, people break a finger and can't work for a week or two and panic about money.
Yes.
7 years I didn't work. And I did not end up under the bridge. I did not end up homeless. I did not end up in places that I shouldn't have been, you know. I was taken care of. And
by whom, by what? I think all of us women or men who are listening to this, we want to know. We need to know that there's a guarantee, there's an assurance that I'm not going to end up under the bridge if something terrible like an illness or a lost job or whatever, you know, because I know for me, that's what haunts me. It's like, oh my God, I don't want to end up under the bridge.
I this is funny that I'm using the word mystery today because it's not one of my words, but that mystery is exactly what I found. Mm. It's not, you know, one day it was one thing and another day it was another thing. But I'll tell you one story. So,
it was the depth
of my illness. My mother had just died. I was in terrible shape. And it was, I was on disability. So that was one thing I could say, hey, the government saved me. For the first year I was on disability, I had a very good income because I had been earning so much money before I got sick. So, but I was so ill. And the year was going by. Eventually it got to the point where it was 6 weeks before the disability was going to run out, and I was in panic mode. And one day I was walking along and I thought, what am I doing? Why am I panicking? I have disability for 6 more weeks. One of the things that I learned in my 12-step community is it's one day at a time. And I just said, this has to end now. It is not over today. I have 6 more weeks of disability coming. Now, a lot of other people would see that as being the moment that you're going to really panic. But to me, I was like, this has to stop now. I am fine today. I have money today. And,
you know, that, again, a wise one, we must.
That's not the end of the story. That is not the end of the story.
Yeah, but I know. I'm just grabbing this thing, which is focus on when you're in panic, focus on one day at a time. Today, you still have a roof over your head. That's all that matters. And then tomorrow, you wake up. If you don't have a roof, then deal with that. But I'm pretty sure that tomorrow you'll still have a roof over your head. And one day at a time. Okay, now
The last day of my disability was a Friday. The day before, a Thursday, I get a phone call from a woman from my spiritual community, and I hadn't spoken to her for 4 or 5 years at that point. She called me up and she said, Shirley Jaya, that's my spiritual name, Joanne, she said, she was a very, very experienced television and filmmaker, and she said, Joanne, I've been hired to make a TV show in the Bay Area. I don't know anyone there. All my connections are in L.A. Can you help me crew the show? I said, of course I can. Well, she didn't know that I had been laying in my bed for a long time and many years, and I hadn't been working in film since I arrived in the Bay Area, and I didn't have connection one. I didn't know any. But I was so thrilled to get the phone call. It was clearly divine intervention to me, and I was so thrilled to have the opportunity to help someone. Mm. That was the phone call. We arranged that we would talk on the Saturday, which was the day after my disability ran out. So between the Thursday and the Saturday, I did everything I could. My priestess came out. I found a bunch of connections, and we had our conversation on the Saturday. And this is the bold, brave woman. I said to her, do you think that I could come and work on the show?
Oh.
And I got an interview, and I worked for the next 4 months on that show. It was called Addicted.
And my, perfect.
My job was in casting, and I was my job was to go out and find addicts that we could audition to see if they could come on the show, do an intervention with them, and put them in treatment that we paid for. And I got to use every skill that I had learned over all of my years of recovery and illness and everything. For the next several months on that show.
Oh, baby. Steve Jobs just popped in and said, see, I told you about those dots. They always make sense when you look back on them. So anyway,
yeah.
Oh, honey, what a triumphant, amazing turnaround story. You are such a good storyteller. We didn't even know this was going to end up right here, but oh, that's so beautiful. I want to like draw a little structure so that people who are listening not just get caught up with your beautiful story, but there's a structure here that I think would be very useful for anyone who's going through any kind of journey, right? First of all, focus it one day at a time. When you feel really desperate and you worry about your future and your kids and all that stuff, just focus on today. Today, that's all you got. And then always be in community, whether it's your church, your spiritual community, your AA, your 12-step, whatever. Be in community. This is not the time to pull away and just be by yourself, because when you're by yourself, you will not make it. But if you are
in
community, magic and miracles will happen.
People
love us. They want to love us. And then the third thing that I heard you said really was just say yes. Like with the phone ring, whatever, they go blah, blah, blah. You say yes.
Yes.
If somebody say, I'm coming over to bring you something, yes. If you know, somebody knocking on the door, just say yes. Because you need that. It's it reminds me of that analogy or that story of the guy who drowned and went to heaven and got really mad at God for not saving him. You know that one?
Yes, that's right.
Right. Yeah, how there was the news that the flood was coming, and he's like, I'm not worried. I got the Lord protected
God's
me.
God's gonna save
right?
me.
Right? Yeah, God's gonna save me. and then what happened? The rain
the
came.
Lifeboat came. The lifeboat came. And
right.
He said, oh, no, it's fine. I'm fine. God's gonna save me. You can go on.
That's right. And then the water rises.
Then the helicopter comes.
Yeah.
The helicopter comes. He's like, don't worry about it. God's going to save me.
Yeah. And then, of course, he drowned.
Then he drowned.
And then he goes, God, I believe in you. Why didn't you drown? Now you get to tell
Oh, he goes to heaven, and St. Peter said, what is wrong with you? We sent you a lifeboat. We sent you a helicopter. Why didn't you take them? and I didn't really say this part of my story, but that call came from somebody that I was afraid of.
Uh-huh. Wow. Of course.
It wasn't somebody that I was like, oh, she called me. That's the thing.
Right.
No.
Right.
No.
So it's like it looks different than how we anticipate it to look.
Yeah.
But please just say yes and find ways. And in the yes, you know, like, what you said, the yes came from a source that was difficult for you to say yes to. And when you look around rationally, practically, you should not have said yes because you didn't have any of what
That's
you were
right.
looking for. But because you are inherently, naturally creative, resourceful, you will find the answer. So just say yes and you'll figure it out later.
That's right.
Right. And then from
That's
there,
right.
you can ask for what you want. It's like, may I humbly, you know, ask humbly, may I do this? Can I do this for you? Will you let me? And before you know it, you're on the upturn.
So I think there's one little piece that's been very useful to me, and which is the last piece, which was, how can I help? And one of the things that I learned while lying in my bed for 7 years was that sometimes the only people who would call me would be people from my 12-step community who wanted help. I had this one guy call me. He drove me nuts. There were weeks when he was the only person who called me. And there were times that I thought that I had no money, no career, no nothing, no external validation in any way. And somebody called me for my help, and I felt better. And I've learned that people love to be asked to help. And so that, I think, is the last piece for me. It's like, often when I don't feel capable in some sort of way, especially in any kind of masculine way, you know, if I can just find somebody and ask them to help, people love to be asked to help. And the funny thing is it's the last thing we want to do. It's like, oh, no, I've got this covered. You know, I can handle this, you know. Instead of, you know, would you mind helping me? You know, could you do this? Could you do it? People love that.
So ask and offer to help others, and at the same time, ask and offer and ask for help for yourself too. So that way you can really, Oh, namaste, honey. We have to bring this to a close. Were you going to have a few last words for the audience?
Yes. Well, this is what I was going to say. It was, could I just share this last piece for me? So I did start to get better. Things got better in my life. I belong to several different communities. For me, community is everything. For somebody who has that missing family, community is even more than everything. It is family. And I was starting to do my business. I was starting to coach filmmakers. I was starting to get some pleasure. And it wasn't until I met you, May, that I was able to fill in a missing piece. And this is the missing piece that I had never been able to get to. That all the years that I had, I've done therapy, I've done this, I've done that, all these things. And I was always told, you know, we need to learn to love ourselves. And I was like, oh, yes, we need to learn to love ourselves. Nobody told me how to do that. I didn't know how to do that. I was like, well, I don't know how to do that. And it wasn't until I started working with you that I started to hear the change in the voice with which I spoke to myself. And one of the first things that I learned as I started learning that process of being able to speak to myself in a kinder, gentler, more compassionate and self-loving voice, I suddenly started to hear the harshness and the hardness in other people's voices towards themselves.
Oh, and baby.
That has been, for me, the most extraordinary miracle. That I now can speak to myself in this loving tone of voice that I never had in my life.
Oh, it's so wonderful to hear that, because it's everything, right? We hear this all the time. You got to love yourself. You got to love yourself. But how? And the more we shoot ourselves to love ourselves, the worse it gets. We end up beating ourselves up for not loving ourselves, which is so paradoxical. Mm-hmm. Thank you, and thank you for sharing that with the audience, and thank you for acknowledging me, and really, it has been such an honor to love you. You're so easy to love.
Thank you.
But I think that part of the magic is how we change our life. You know, it is a very important thing to be bold and brave in the world, and I honor all of our bold and brave journey, every step of the way, however it looks like. And at the same time, there's a danger in being bold and brave, is that we can set ourselves up for so much boldness and bravery that we end up saying no to love. We end up making ourselves really difficult to love. And that, I don't want that. And that's
I don't know anything about that, May.
And that's why I do these shows, and I try to go really in depth to help you understand the complexity and the gentleness of this, you know, and to keep nourishing yourself with self-love, acceptance and joy and humor, and don't be alone. So if you're looking for a community to belong to, we've named a few that has been tried and true, right? The 12 step, the AA programs, all this stuff out there. And online, you know, check us out, the Bold Brave Women on Facebook or LinkedIn. Just look for Bold Brave Women and ask to join. And I'd be so thrilled to add you to the group. And you can read and learn and commune with other women, share your everyday Bold Brave moment or your big-ass lifetime Bold Brave woman, so that we can really acknowledge and love you. And then get on my radio show and tell the story, and we can look for depth and gems and jewels to share back with everyone out there. So namaste, everyone. Have a wonderful night or day wherever you're listening to this from. My name is May Vu. Join us on the Bold Brave Woman. Find me on Facebook or anywhere. Actually, I'm all over social media. And Joanne Butcher, thank you so much, darling, for your wisdom and for sharing with us your wise one and your
thank
spiritual
you,
journey.
May. Thank you so much.
Namaste.
Namaste.